step by step.
I want to welcome everybody to the Fort Lauderdale Primary Purpose Big Book Study Group, Thursday night, Alcoholics and God Speaker Step Series. Let's start with our joke now.
Hey, Spencer, alcoholic. And I got one from Take Me to Your Sponsor, Best Jokes and Cartoons from A.A. Grapevine. A drunk stumbles into a biker bar and orders a drink. He sees three men sitting at a corner table. He staggers over and looks with the biggest, meanest biker in the face and says, "I was at your grandma's house today, and man, she is one fine-looking woman." The biker doesn't say a word. His buddies are confused because he's one bad biker and would fight at the drop of a hat. The drunk leans over again and says, "I made out with your grandma, and she's the best kisser I've ever met." Oh my God. The biker's buddies are starting to get mad, but the biker still says nothing. The drunk leans on the table one more time and says, "I tell you something else, boy. Your grandma really liked it." At this point, the biker stands up, takes the drunk by the shoulders, looks him square in the eyes, and says, "Grandpa, go home."
Good one, Spencer. Thank you. I'm a recovered alcoholic. My name is Guy. I'm a member of this group also. Thanks for joining us tonight. In a minute, we're going to start our two-minute meditation. So take a minute to get situated. Please turn off those cell phones and any other device that makes noise. That includes texting. It's distracting to others. Take this time to let the craziness of the day go away and get connected to God and stay focused on our step study tonight. Is everybody ready for the meditation?
Yes, sir.
Okay, let's just start it.
Thank you.
And we're going to do the fog light prayer right up here on the screen. God, let your love shine through me like a fog light, so those who are lost, sick, and dying can find your love through me. There is a solution from the big book, page 17. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. We have a way out which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. I've asked Don to read Appendix 2, Spiritual Experience. We read this because the main purpose of the 12 steps is to have one, so it's kind of important to know what one is. Don?
Good evening, I'm Don.
Hey, Don.
Hey, guys. Here's Spiritual Experience. The term spiritual experience and spiritual awakening are used many times in this book, which, upon careful reading, shows that the personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism has manifested itself among us in many different forms. Yet it is true that our first printing gave many readers the impression that these personality changes or religious experiences must be in the nature of sudden and spectacular upheavals. Happily for everyone, this conclusion is erroneous. In the first few chapters, a number of sudden revolutionary changes are described. Though it was not our intention to create such an impression, many alcoholics have nevertheless concluded that in order to recover, they must acquire an immediate and overwhelming God consciousness, followed at once by a vast change in feeling and outlook. Among our rapidly growing membership of thousands of alcoholics, such transformation, though frequent, are by no means the rule. Most of our experience are what the psychologist William James calls the educational variety, because they develop slowly over a period of time. Quite often, friends of the newcomer are aware of differences long before he is himself. He finally realizes that he has undergone a profound alteration in his reaction to life, that such a change could hardly have been brought about by himself alone. What often takes place in a few months could have seldom been accomplished by years of self-discipline. With few exceptions, our members find that they have tapped an unsuspected inner resource, which they presently identify with their own conception of a power greater than themselves. Most of us think this awareness of a power greater than themselves is the essence of spiritual experience. Our more religious members call it God consciousness. Most emphatically, we wish to say that any alcoholic capable of honestly facing his problems in the light of our experience can recover, provided he does not close his mind to all spiritual concepts. He can only be defeated by an attitude of intolerance or belligerent denial. We find that no one need have difficulty with the spirituality of the program. Willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness are the essentials of recovery, but these are indispensable. There is a principle which is bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation. Herbert Spencer. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you, Don. Please refrain from disturbing others by talking or constantly getting up and sitting back down. This is a tech-free meeting, so please set your phones to airplane mode or just turn them off. And tonight, for the next six sessions, we've got a terrific speaker. His name is Stevie B. Let's give him a nice round of applause.
Hi, everybody. My name is Stevie B. I'm a recovered alcoholic.
Hey, Stevie.
I'm so blessed to be here with you guys tonight. I'm so excited. It's taken me a long time to get here. I have to tell you, I'm not sure how sick I really am, but that grandma joke kind of got me juiced up. I'm just going to say. In the first step, how it was, it's very easy to go back all the way to how it was. But my friend, Sister Jackie, was just praying over me, and she asked the Lord to give me a fresh anointing today, something different than we've had before. And I'm really excited about that, because after you've done many step series, and I'm blessed to be able to do them. I love them. I love being here with you guys. But hearing kind of the same old stories is difficult even for the speaker. And as I was coming in tonight, and I was thinking about the powerlessness of alcohol and how my life had become unmanageable and how our lives become manageable, I realized that the problem on page 52 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, where it speaks about the bedevilments, as I was coming up on Las Olas with my mom. My beautiful mom is here tonight. I'm so excited to have her here. Because she just she's traveling with a lot of different things going against her. She just came up with Lyme disease a couple months ago, and it's a miracle. This is our first nighttime meeting, and so great to be here with Mom. And I was traveling up here, and one of the streets that's close to here that we come up on is Las Olas Boulevard. And as I was thinking of how it was, as opposed to how it is today, I didn't have the thoughts of my childhood, which was great. I grew up in a great home with two loving parents and a beautiful younger sister that I grew up with, and an older stepsister who I love. And the whole environment was loving. The Northeast is a lot of things, but it's a loving family environment. I grew up in a time when my mom would let us out in the morning, and we would come back at night. And you never even thought of anything right. Right, Paul? You never even thought of it. You just go out, you played, you drank the water from the faucets on the side of the high school. We weren't thinking about filtration systems. We weren't thinking about, putting on gloves, eating. We ate what was around. You know, someone would come to the school and give us some sandwiches. You didn't think about washing your hands and where the water came from. Matter of fact, the worse the water tasted, the better it worked, basically, from the side of the high school. It was good times, and yet, if you asked me during that time if everything was okay, there was a time when everything was okay. And then very quickly, there was a time when everything was not okay. I had like a rubber band that was slowly tightening around my stomach, around my chest. I had something called anxiety when a child shouldn't have anxiety. And there was no reason to have anxiety. There was nothing that I wanted for. I mean, maybe school. I hear a lot of the speakers. By the way, listening to Pat is just and Peter and all the speakers I have here. I'm just in awe. I'm a regular garden variety guy that's not super bright. And I wasn't super bright in school. A lot of the people that come over, they excelled in school. I didn't excel in school. School was difficult for me. I had a lot of thoughts going on at all the same time. It was hard for me to pay attention. Maybe they would call me, maybe modern day would be something like attention. I don't know if I had attention deficit. I had attention, but just not to what was going on in the school. I was very attentive to what's going on outside and to the girls. I had great attention. But I didn't have great attention to what was being taught on the chalkboard. And so that was my first angst or anxiety, that I felt like everybody in the school got it. I felt like I missed the class that explained school. Like every time we had a speaker last night, he was unbelievable, and I kind of felt that he was such a wordsmith, and he was talking with an English accent, and everything was hitting me at one time, and I kind of felt like that, like last night at the meeting. I'm like, everything's going over my head. Sometimes when Peter speaks, sometimes it goes right over my head. I'm like, this is advanced AA, and I'm kind of like, by the way, if you're looking for advanced AA, that's not this step series. You're going to get regular, garden variety, not that bright AA. And when I was in school, I felt like everybody got it. Jerry got it. Everybody got it. And for me, I always felt like I was, you know, one crayon short of the box being full. And so early on, I knew that I had to make up for lack of focus, or in my mind, I thought it was lack of intelligence. It wasn't lack of intelligence. It was just lack of being interested. I was disinterested. And so I came up with a plan. I was going to have to be I was going to have some ingenious techniques to get through school. When you have to have ingenious techniques to get through school, that causes anxiety. And, you know, one of those, I was a master cheat. But that causes anxiety. You know, you have to go to school with different papers in all different places and all the stuff on your wrists. And one time I came up with a cassette system where I had the whole Italian, you know, my entire test on my cassettes with a hat that came down, and you have to be rewinding and fast forward. That's a stressful situation. And so that was my first in school was my first time to feel anxiety. But I saw the other kids, they were wearing it like a loose garment. It didn't really seem like a big deal to them. And everything for me was a big deal. I don't know if you have that. You're very sensitive. I was very sensitive. You know, my dad would say something to me that was probably just like I say to my son tonight. Like my mom said to me tonight, you know, maybe you can correct a little bit, you know, less correcting and more like loving. But to me, I was super sensitive. Everything my dad said to me, I took to the heart. Everything the other kids said to me, I took to the heart. And so I started to develop resentments without ever knowing what the word resentment was. I had resentments against the other kids. I had resentments against them because they had big brothers. In my neighborhood, everybody on my block seemed to have big brothers. Every family that we knew on my block had big brothers. The Wagamans, the Cohens, the Mundingers, the Mottas. They all had three brothers. They were mostly Irish or German. They were just strong kids. And although we had a lot of Jewish kids in my neighborhood, they had big brothers too. Everybody had big brothers. And I had a little chubby sister, just one little chubby sister. And for me, that created like an anxiety, because when you walk to the playground with big monstrous brothers, you get built-in respect. And you also know how to play sports better. And you also are tougher, because you've been beaten up at home and smacked around, and you know how to play ball. And I had a little sister. And she was in ballet, and I was in karate, and we didn't have any really of the moxie in my neighborhood. And so I had this built-in idea that if I had big brothers, everything would have been different. And this is the beginning of me coming up with ideas on how my insides are different from your outsides. And the way that I feel, you can't understand. You know, this is the time where I start to develop feelings of that you can't understand. Well, you don't understand. You know, you really don't understand. And this is also the time when I started lying. And I didn't really know I was lying. Like I had heard in my family, like someone said something to my family, and I would take it, and I would take it to the playground, but I didn't really have the intelligence or the maturity to back it up. You know, so like one time I had heard someone say, which turns out later down the road that it turns out to be true, but that I was a junior. Like someone said in my family, I was a junior. But then I went to the playground and they're like, "What's your dad's name?" And I'm like, "I'm Steven Jr." And they're like, "I thought your dad's name was Stanley." And I'm like, "Yeah, it is." So nothing. I didn't have anything to back up my lies. There was no maturity. But one time in high school. There was a new coach, and he came, and I went to a big school, like 2,000 kids. My class is 500, and I was like the top of, you know, the middle. I was the top of the middle of my class. Like out of 500 kids, I was 251. I was like the top of the middle, and the coach looked at the roster, and he goes, "Boyarsky, that's my last name." And he says, "Boyarsky, does your brother play for the Pittsburgh Panthers?" Now, I had a stepbrother that was a plumber and that lived in Massachusetts. So it's a pretty quick, No, but I knew everything was about to change for me at that moment. And I said, yes, coach, he does. Like, and all the kids that I'd grown up with for 8 years, they looked over and they're like, what are you talking about? And I'm like, yeah, that's my brother. That's right. And that's the way my childhood went. I would make up stuff, and I would back it up so long that it would become mine. And By the way, the guy's name is Jerry Boyarsky, and I've been backing that story up my entire life. Just recently, like in the last 10 years, we were in a locker room with my dad, may God rest his soul, and he was waiting to get a treatment in a gym, and they came in and they said, Mr. Boyarsky, and my dad says yes, and there was a guy in the gym. This has just happened. This is just recently. We're talking about 50 years later. And he said, Boyarsky, are you related to Jerry Boyarsky? And my head snapped around. And I'm 10 years sober, and I almost said, yes, we are. That's my brother. That's a true story. And I'm so glad I didn't, because it turns out the guy was in AA, and he saw me in AA at the later part of the week. He goes, do you remember I met you? And I'm like, yes, absolutely, I remember. But I didn't tell him what a mental patient I can be. So as I'm driving in here tonight, the blessing of being with my mom, the blessing with being some dear friends in the car, I remembered how it was. Not from high school, not from the first drink, not from my first alcoholic incident that didn't have anything to do with alcohol. Because some of you in here, you may have become alcoholics because you drank and you became addicted to alcohol. I was an alcoholic before I ever took my first drink. I had alcoholism before I ever took my first drink. What does that mean? It means that the moment I took my first drink, the rubber band that was tight around my stomach and my chest loosened up. The moment I took my first drink, that ease and comfort that they speak about in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I felt it. I was like, this is amazing. And I'm not talking about drunk. It was years before I got drunk. Well, my first drink was a Jewish table wine by the name of Manischewitz Jewish table wine. We're not talking about anything powerful. We're talking about Concord grape juice with some alcohol in it. But that's that little tiny bit of alcohol when you add it to an alcoholic body, which then gets transferred in an alcoholic mind, which gets sent around in the alcoholic system. That's the magic elixir that I was looking for, and I had no idea. And at that moment, I knew that this is some magical stuff. And I had watched my dad. My dad said he was an alcoholic. I'm not going to argue with him. He died with 28 years in Gamblers Anonymous, may God rest his soul. He died with 21 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he said he was an alcoholic. I didn't see, you know, he wasn't rolled up in a carpet like I was. You know, he didn't pull in his car. You know, it was a different era. He didn't lose his shoes. You know, he was definitely a functioning alcoholic. But he called himself that. So I'm gonna go with it. But what I did see him do is I saw him drink. And make faces. Like, I saw him drink Jack Daniels on a regular basis. I've only seen him drunk twice. But I saw him drink and make faces. And after the face, there was a difference in the behavior. He would down a shot of Jack Daniels like, well, you don't know, other than Paul and Maddie, nobody knows John Wayne in here. But he would take it like, he would drink a shot and he would make a face and he'd go, and I liked that look. Now, I didn't know that I was shooting for that look. I didn't know that it was going to take a lot of work to get there. I just knew that the first time I had that Manischewitz Jewish table wine, that I had a release of the rubber band that was tied around my chest that I call anxiety. But that doesn't take me to the story of Las Olas. 20 years later, I'm in a hospital around the corner from here. I'm in a hospital that's on Las Olas. The same street that I drove up here tonight in my mom's beautiful car, smelling of new leather. My mom trusts me to drive. And I have one eye, so that's a very big deal. She knows that I've been sober. You know, God willing, I'll be sober coming up next month, or 23 years, January 23 years. And it took me back to where they dropped me off 23 years ago, October 11th, 2001. And I was in the hospital on Las Olas. Las Olas, if you don't know, is this beautiful street with all money and shops and restaurants and people that are frolicking, you know, just like out of the Big Book. And they're having a good time, and they have an ease and a comfort, and they're buying stuff, and it's great, great time. And I was in a psychiatric hospital on Las Olas. And I was on a psychiatric hospital in Las Olas because I had 7 years of sobriety, and I gave it away for the idea that I could have a drink like a normal person. Why? Because I had sobered up when I was 24, and now I was 31, and I knew as long as I didn't do drugs, of course I'm not going to do drugs. That's not even in the equation. If I go to my first step on drugs and I see that I'm powerless, of course I'm powerless over drugs. I pawned a brand new car for $1,200 so that I could get high. That's evidence. Right? I always thought the police were coming into the house, and for days I would spend time peeping out a window, a peephole, for days, and I only have one eye, so you can imagine how hard that is. Okay? If you don't have to, try it. That's hard. You have to keep going. It's hard. And so you got two eyes, so you're like, well, it doesn't seem that hard. No, it's hard. I was arrested several times, which I didn't grow up that way. I drove under the influence. I got six felonies in one night, which I'll tell you about down the road. In one night, six felonies. Charged with six felonies. I did jail time, Jerry. I did jail time. Regardless of how much you want to say I didn't, I was in jail. That's not true. I don't need any heckling. I grew up in a good home that told me they loved me. We celebrated religious holidays. We went to church most of the time. We grew up in a spiritual home. There was praying. My mother did the sign of the cross on me every time I went outside. They were very Catholic. We had a lot of holy oils and anointing oils and all good stuff. Very amount of times I saw my parents fight are on two hands in all those years, and yet I had an angst, I had an anxiety, I had an agita, you know what that is, that constantly told me something was wrong. And I saw different parts of my family. The Italian side of the family had different anxieties, but they were happy. We always had some type of liquor on the table, some sweet liquor, and then always JB. I don't, what's that? I think that's scotch. Always, there was always JB around and everything. JB was always at all dinners. And then the Jewish side of my family, there was always they liked the Jewish drink, but then there was an Irishman in there on the Jewish side, and he would drink the Jack Daniels with my dad. And alcohol was always a good time in my house. And it didn't really seem like that was an issue. That wasn't the issue. I was the issue. And I started to develop a lot of health issues when I was younger. I was out of school a lot, and it was all in my head. Every time there was a test, I developed a fever. Every time there was a test I didn't study for, my fever spiked through the roof. Because in my room, there was a radiator. And I found out if you put the thermometer on the radiator, you can spike that fever anytime you need. So I missed a lot of school. Plus, my dad was not real. My dad and mom were. My dad never missed a day of work that I ever remembered, ever. And he was like like an amateur apothecary. And he grew up very poor, so it's not like we went to doctors all the time. Even if we needed to, I can't remember going to doctors that much. But so my dad treated a lot of the things in my house with alcohol. He had a lot of tinctures. You know, if you had stomach, I had a lot of stomach issues when I was younger. If you had stomach issues, that's blackberry brandy. That worked very, very well for stomach issues. If you have a sore throat, that's like a hot toddy. That's a hot toddy. You couldn't sleep. My dad was famous for the little shot, one of those sweet things like amaretto if you couldn't sleep. So what happened to me? I developed a lot of issues. I had a lot of issues. But alcohol was always around, and alcohol was always my friend. I don't know if you've ever heard that. It was fun, then it was fun with problems, and then it ended up in problems. Well, I was in the fun for a long time. It's not like I just ran in here, you know, after being out of Bloody Mary mix one night. It was a good time for a little while. But then drugs came in. And I'm not going to talk about drugs for my story because I'm a real alcoholic, but I'm definitely not a pure alcoholic. And I want to thank drugs because drugs definitely accelerated me getting into AA. Because I got into my first treatment center when I was 21. If I was an alcoholic like that guy, I could have been out there for a very long time. Because alcohol, to me, was less disastrous, although definitely menacing. But did I find out I was powerless over alcohol? Yeah, but not right away. Alcohol is a very subtle foe. It's patient. It's cunning. It's baffling. It doesn't let you know that it's the rapacious creditor, which means it's the creditor that doesn't stop coming all the time. It's something that waits in the background for me. I wasn't you know, in the very beginning, like drinking alcoholically because I had drugs. And I grew up in the 80s and the 70s. And the drugs I did, you could do more alcohol, and it was like masking. It was like they went well together. And somehow I, against my own alcoholism, I somehow got into college because I do a great. You see my mother laughing? That's not right. It's not right. I'm a great interviewer. I'm a great interviewee. Excuse me. I'm phenomenal on interviews. Now none of the process is truthful. So usually they find out, like, you know, the first week into the job. But I've gotten some amazing. I've gotten like directorships, doctorships. You know, like I've gotten some very serious. I've been employed at very serious places for very short amounts of time. And one of those, that's how I got to college. Because they thought they were getting a superstar, and then they just found out they were just getting super. And I want to just backtrack for a second. Because what shaped a lot of my high school is that I shot myself in the eye. And I'm not going to go over that. It's only 6 weeks. I'm just going to give you the quick story of that. Is that I wanted to hang out with this kid so badly, the toughest kid in my neighborhood, that I was willing to give him a gun, which was my gun, and I was willing to come up with a game, which is called shoot at me, and I was not very good at the game. And he shot at me, and I lost my eye. And, you know, thank God to Alcoholics Anonymous and the fourth step and the fifth step, that showed me, and we're not there yet, but we will be just in the next couple weeks, that showed me in something called the fourth column, where was I wrong? And where was I wrong? I was wrong across the entire board. It had nothing to do with this other kid. He was just a kid, 1 year older than me, a kid. So at 12, I get shot. A 13-year-old does it, and I carry this 13-year-old's name on my heart for 7 years or 10 years or 14 years, hating this kid for shooting my eye out, but finding out he was a victim of a game I came up with. And that's the most amazing thing about Alcoholics Anonymous. You're going to be able to, by working these steps, are you going to have a spiritual experience as the result of these steps? Absolutely. Are you going to know a new freedom and a new happiness? Absolutely. God bless you. Are you going to have a life beyond your wildest dreams? Yes. And in that process, you're going to let go of things that you would normally carry to the end of your life, because that's what we do as human beings. We carry poop. But Alcoholics Anonymous is the great poop master. It allows you to let go of the things that you shouldn't be carrying and that are going to cause you cancer. They're going to cause you relapse. They're going to cause you different things. If you can't let go of things, they will eat you up from the inside. And I was able to let that young man go. And as a matter of fact, something that's come recently to me, Mom, is that I actually want to make amends to him for all those years of holding him hostage to a decision that I made with my own gun in my own backyard with my own idea that it was his, that he was just part of it. And I hated him for years. And I actually recently want to get together with him and just make amends for that, or just actually break bread. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous will do for you, right, Jerry? That's what it does. It sets you on a new path of life. So I lose my eye. I lose time in school. I start taking some opiates because of the eye. That doesn't make me an addict. My dad giving me alcohol when I was younger, that didn't make me an alcoholic. Me smoking weed with the kids in school, that didn't make me a pot addict. Me looking in a strip club when I was 12 didn't make me a sex addict. All this stuff was in me. It was all in me. It was waiting to come out. I told you I got a little bit of, a little juiced up with the joke. Bad Steve is in there. Good Steve wins in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Bad Steve doesn't want me to pray on my knees in the morning before I get out of the house. Good Steve says, get on your knees, ask God to direct your day. Go to page 86, 87, and 88, where it says, upon awakening, let's think about the 24 hours a day ahead. Don't get in the way, Bad Steve. Don't get in the way. Let's get Good Steve in there really, really quick, because Bad Steve wakes up and he's like, hi. Yesterday, I even cursed, and I don't curse. Bad Steve woke up before Good Steve, and I said the F curse. I couldn't even believe it. My wife said, what happened? I said, I don't know. Bad Steve woke up before Good Steve. I immediately got on my knees. I asked the Lord for forgiveness. I asked him to direct my day, but it reminded me that that guy's just waiting to get out. We had to ask ourselves why we shouldn't apply to our human problems the same readiness to change our point of view. This is page 52, The Bedevilments. We were having trouble with personal relationships. Raise your hand before you came in alcoholics, or maybe even just recently, you were having trouble with personal relationships. Yeah. We couldn't control our emotional natures. Chime in here for saying, of course it can still be that. On any given day, alcoholism does not need alcohol to make the situation worse. Alcoholism survives in an alcoholic in a lack of program, in a lack of spirituality. I was 7 years sober, and I was worse than I was before Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was casually around Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I didn't think I had a problem, so I wasn't even aware of it. At least when you're high and you're rolled up in a carpet and you're driving drunk, at least you know there's a problem. So when you're at work, you're not like, when you're drunk, you're like very nice at work. You're like, hey, But when you're sober, but you're not working a program, you think it's everybody else's problem. So my brother said over here, he goes, I can still be that way. Of course we can. I was an alcoholic at 12 and I never had a drink, and I gave another kid a gun and told him to shoot me. I don't need alcohol to be a jerk. Alcohol only accentuated the problem. I could be a jerk sober on any given day without God. It's only by the maintenance of our spiritual condition that we stay saintly at all, that we stay anyway saintly. And what do I mean by saintly? Godly. I have a friend that in his very room cursed out the Apostle Peter one time. In this very room. He said bad things about the Apostle Peter. May God rest his soul. Of course, since then, he's made amends. But that's who we are on any given day. There's the good version. and then there's the worldly version. There's the worldly clamors, and then there's the spiritual rocket ship. And every day we get up, we have a choice. We were prone to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. I couldn't make a living. Some of you guys were very functional. I was not. Like Pat said last week, it's hard to be a functioning crack addict. I do agree with him on that. We had the feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. I want to stop at that. I was full of fear every day of my using life. Until I got a drink. Until I got a fix. Until I got... If I did not have my drug in me, whatever that was, I'm going to just say alcohol going forward. If I didn't have alcohol in me on that day, I was full of fear. And then there's 50 forms of fear around it. Am I going to have enough money to get the alcohol? Is it going to run out? Where am I going to get it? Are the police going to arrest me? Do I have to? There's a million forms of fear around the alcohol, let alone when am I going to get it in me? We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. These are the bedevilments on page 52. Now, maybe if you've been to the program a while, you realize that some of these sound like they're going to get answered in step 9. In the middle of step 9, it says, were these extravagant promises? We think not. And these get handled. Yeah, they get handled. Not only do they get handled, the bedevilments get taken away one day at a time. They get eradicated. I come into the program when I'm 21 years old. By the grace of God, my mom and dad sent me to a treatment center. I stay sober all the way till, you know, I had a couple of relapses, but then I stay sober for a very, very long time until I'm 31 years old. And at 31, I'm sicker than I was at 21. Because now I got a belly full of AA. I got a pocket full of money. I've been shooting steroids, so my arms are huge. I got all my hair still. And I think I know everything. I got all the answers. When I would go to meetings, I would park outside the 12-step house in the handicap so everyone could see my triple black Mustang Cobra with the top down. And I would walk into AA and be like, yo, the kid is here. That was my mom, by the way. I was so delusional and so demented that I had no idea who I was. If you told me I looked good, I felt I looked good. If you told me I was something, then everything had to come from you. God forbid you would tell me, God forbid you would say to me something like, oh, I see you stopped working out. You wouldn't see me for a month. I'd be in the gym every day, all day. A simple word from you could destroy my entire life. If I'm not with God, I am with me, and with me, alcoholism resides. The only way that I'm recovered from the seemingly hopeless state of mind and body is when I take my life and I put it on a spiritual plane. So, I'm on Las Olas. I drive, I park my mom's beautiful car outside. She trusts me with the keys. 23 years ago, I remember we had to say to the behavioral health tech, we needed a tobacco break. And then she would get us all together in our outfits, which was gowns, because I was not on the well floor. I was on the floor that they took your shoelaces because I was on suicide watch. And I remember that they allowed us in a line to walk down Las Olas with the tech. And I knew incomprehensible demoralization like I had never known before. Remember, just a couple months ago, I had a car and a house and a wife and a triple black Mustang Cobra and muscles and hair gel. On suicide watch, they take your hair gel. That's terrible. and they're marching. Now, she wasn't debasing us. She wasn't embarrassing us. This woman was beautiful, and she said to the director, they need some air, and she took us out for an air walk. She did something that nobody else was doing. You don't have to take the patients out on Las Olas in their gowns, but she knew it would be good for us. Because we were the suicide watch floor. And I remember without a penny in my pocket, without money for the soda machine, Tall Tom came in from our home group. Remember Tall Tom, Mom? And he came in to bring a meeting into the Las Olas, into the Fort Lauderdale Hospital. And I saw Tom, and I remember what my first question was, Tom, could I get a dollar for the soda machine? I had no hope. I had lost it all. I had no self-esteem. I had no toiletries. I didn't know if I was ever going to be able to get out of that. And because some of the drugs that I did were also affected my mind, I never knew if my mind was going to come back. Because when I got back to work, I was not able to function at work. I had no memory. A person would come in and order, Joe remembers, he was there. A person would come in and they would order business cards for me. And then they would come back and they'd say, Steve, do you have the business cards done? And I'd say, who are you? A person would put in an order for t-shirts. And I would take the order for the t-shirts. And they would come back a half an hour later. And I'd say, who are you? If my beautiful mom, who came out of retirement with my beautiful dad, if they touched my skin during those first months, I would jump through the roof because you weren't able to touch my skin. I had lost all hope. I had lost brain power. And things I always relied on, which was muscles and smiles and white teeth and hair gel and memory and quick wit, gone. Everything had been stripping from me. No, everything I gave away. I gave all that away for the idea that I could have one glass of wine after having 7 years of sobriety. I believed that I could have one glass of wine. Because as long as I didn't do drugs, I didn't think that wine would ever bring me back to that place. And I had never gotten high or drunk in Florida. Next week, I'm not wearing a jacket. I'm just going to tell you right now. It's too much. It's too much for me. I'm fitting everywhere. I got water flowing out. You cannot see what's going on behind this jacket. There's a puddle behind me right now. I had never gotten drunk in Florida. I didn't know drunk in Florida. I knew drunk in Minnesota. I knew drunk in Pennsylvania. I knew drunk in Florida before I got sober, you know, at the Elbow Room. But then I got sober. And once I got sober, I had never known relapse. I only knew sober. I only knew sober people. I only knew sober behavior. My schedule was centered around sober. But somehow in my mind, by lack of working a program, you can become powerless over alcohol and your life can become unmanageable sober. I want you to know that this is not about drunk. Drunk is the end result of an unstable, double-minded behavior. There's people in the room tonight, they believe they don't have an alcohol problem. And this is what I've explained to them. It doesn't matter if you don't have an alcohol problem. If you drink and you gamble away your life savings, you have an alcohol problem. If you drink and you get naked and you're arrested for nakedness, you have an alcohol problem. So whether you believe that it's the problem, it's always in the mix. Every time I got drunk, I had a fist fight. I thought fist fighting was part of drinking. It was an even allotted time of night. We would get to a certain time and be like, well, no girls are going to be with us. Let's fight some people. That's the most alcoholic idea in the entire world. Am I right, Frankie? Who comes up with these type of things? Wake up the next day, my nose is smashed, my one good eye is looking in the wrong direction. I'm like, Was that a party? On January 2nd, 2002, I had been brought to the Fort Lauderdale Hospital on October 11th of 2001. That's Columbus Day. That's 23 years ago, Columbus Day. Right down this street, there's a 7-Eleven. I don't know if it's still there, but there's a 7-Eleven right down the street. And I came up with a plan to throw myself into traffic because I had no hope. And it was this little redheaded guy. I don't mean little. I mean a shorter redheaded man that I owe my life to, at least that one time. His name is Randy. He was in AA. I've never seen him again. But I know he was a real person because he had been in our home group several times. And Randy happened to be there when I was crying my eyes out, a grown man, 34 years old, in the 7-Eleven, crying his 33 years old, crying his eyes out, hopeless, wanting to throw himself in traffic. Parents are in the next room, right next door in the Fort Lauderdale Hospital. They gave me $5 to go next door to get a Yoo-Hoo and a tin of tobacco. And I'm crying and I'm holding on to one of the cabinets there. And Randy puts his hand on my shoulder. A member of Alcoholics Anonymous happens to be there. And he says, Stevie B, you'll get back. And I say, I'll never get back. That hopelessness and incomprehensible demoralization that only an alcoholic in the desperate throes of alcoholism knows. You don't meet people on the street and then they say, well, how many times in your life did you want to kill yourself? Most people, it's zero. They have a situation, they handle it. It's tough, they work through it. We drink. And then when we drink, we get drunk. And then drunk tells us to do things that we would not normally do. And I knew that when my wife had come back from the country of Colombia and she saw our house completely destroyed, and she saw the state I was in, there was no way our marriage was going to survive. And it almost didn't. Our house was destroyed, and it was. How did our house get destroyed? Because when I get drunk, my house takes a toll. I believe the police are going to rush in at any time, so I hide stuff everywhere. In pipes, behind pictures. I punch a hole in the wall, and I hide a bottle behind there. And then when I use bottle, use your imagination. And I hide a bottle behind a pitcher, because I believe the police are coming in right at that moment. And then I sit there on the couch and I act like I'm watching TV. And when they come in, I'm going to be indignant. What are you doing here? I'm watching the news. You just barge in the house while I'm sitting on the couch in my house? They don't come in. I calm down. I take the picture down and realize the wall is not solid, which means the stuff I put in a paper, in a plastic bag behind the picture is now behind the wall on the floor. That's what happens. Now, when I'm calmed down, I become Howie the handyman. And out comes the tools. I got to get the stuff from the floor behind the wall. And that happened over and over until my beautiful parents came and they saw our house completely destroyed. And so I knew my only option was to take myself out. And by the grace of God, 23 years later, I get to be around amazing men and women. I know a life beyond my wildest dreams. Is my life easy financially? No, it never has been, and it may never be. I'm on the manna program, which means God gives me enough to eat each day. I wouldn't be on the excess program. He's like, no, Steve, you're going to be on the manna program. I'm going to give you just enough for today, and tomorrow we're going to have a discussion about tomorrow. I have a beautiful family. I have an amazing mom. My dad left planet Earth, may God rest his soul, with 28 years, telling me how much he loved me over and over. And he told me I was a winner and how special I was and how much. And he couldn't stand me. He couldn't stand my voice. When I used to speak, my dad used to cringe. And they went to every step series I ever did. For all the years that I was, that they were here, they never missed one step series, no matter where it was. And if I was across the country, they watched it. And if it was in the middle of the day because I was speaking in Washington, they watched it. And if it was in this church, they watched it. And when I went to church, they came. So I want you to know something. I'll be back next week. And then I'll do 2 and 3 together next week. Okay? By the way, none of this is going to flow like when the Giants are here. Okay? It's going to be more like Pulp Fiction. At the end of the 6 weeks, we will have done the 12 steps in their entirety, but most of them will be done in the last week. God bless you guys.
Let's thank Stevie B again. Now we're due for our secretary's report.
Hey, my name's Spencer, and I'm your recovered alcoholic secretary.
Hey, Spencer.
In keeping with our seventh tradition, which states that every group shall be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions, the baskets are now going around. We also have QR codes located by, with a home group member. Find one and you can get one. I've asked Kenneth to read the recovered statement. We read this notice to explain why many people in AA identify as recovered rather than recovering and what it exactly means to be a recovered alcoholic. Let's welcome Kenneth.
Hello, I'm Kenneth, recovering alcoholic. Recovered. We are not cured of alcoholism. Recovered, but not cured. That presents a conflict to some alcoholics. If we were cured, we would be able to drink responsibly. No, we are not cured. The allergic reaction to alcohol will remain with us for our lifetime. But we have been restored to sanity. That was the problem. The main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body. We are now sane where alcohol is concerned. Consequently, we have recovered.
Nineteen forty style Big Book sponsorship from Forward to Second Edition Alcoholics Anonymous of alcoholics who came to AA and really tried. 50% got sober at once and remained that way. 25% sobered up after some relapses, and among the remainder, those who stayed on with AA showed improvement. What we've seen, felt, come to believe, and experience is that God has not changed over time, and neither should the sacred approach back to his loving arms. The statistics above suggest a 75% success rate. If anyone is needing a sponsor, please raise your hand or stand. All right, we got one in the front here. All right, and please, after the meeting, you can go stand by the piano and someone will come out and help you. Let's help these folks get back to God. Can the recovered alcoholics please raise your hand? All right. If your hand's not raised, we suggest hanging out with those who were. It doesn't look like we have any screen announcements, or we do, which means I need this one. Intergroup is where you can buy AA-related literature and medallions. Intergroup is also responsible for creating our where and when and scheduling the AA hotline. Stop by and visit them. Broward County Institutions Committee is responsible for bringing meetings into places where people like us can't get out to an AA meeting, such as jails, detoxes, and rehabs. They meet monthly to organize the meeting schedule at the 12-step house. Do we have any members of BCIC here tonight?
No, we have Jay.
All right.
Here are some upcoming service opportunities. They have BCIC Appreciation Day. That's going to include lunch with two great speakers, I hear. That's at the 12 Step House on 12/14/24 from 10 to noon. We have Stevie B for 5 more weeks. How exciting! And of course, we have our home group's Monday Night Big Book Study workshop, where the Big Book comes alive. Join us at 6:30 for fellowship, and the workshop starts at 7:15. Back to the report. We have CDs, mugs, large print Big Books, little red books, and Big Book dictionaries for sale. We meet every Thursday starting promptly at 7:15, and we ask that you be courteous and ready to begin at the sound of the bells. See you next week.
You know, I'd like to invite everybody again to our Big Book Study. It meets in this room at Monday nights at 7:15. We're just finishing up on Bill's story. And those who wish to speak, thank our speaker tonight, please line up down the center aisle. Let's give Stevie B. another round of applause. And we're going to close seated with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father,
who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. Keep coming.
Heart is heavy, soul is thirsty, body's aching. I am desperately in need of restoration. Just can't get it right. It doesn't matter. just can't get you right. It doesn't matter how hard I try, but with you I become a much stronger man. Getting on my knees puts me back on my feet again. On my own, I just can't get it right. It doesn't matter how hard I try, but with you I become a much stronger man. Thank you.
light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. Let it shine, 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 let it shine.
Chase, here's that song you've been asking me for a million years. I finally pulled it out the corners of my mind, and here you go. Song is. God bless. I love you, Mike Chase. Bye.
I think you know this one, don't you? Ah! shine a light on me tonight. Lord, shine a light on me tonight. There's no place for a woman like me. My hands are dirty, but my soul is clean. So Lord, shine a light on me. These hands right down to the bone. I work these hands right down to the bone. I've worked so hard for someone I don't know. I watch these walls be bought and sold, so low. Got one man that just won't say.